Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. In this episode, my guest is Mary Johnson, and our conversation is an introduction to nutrient-dense farming. Mary is a permaculture teacher, owner of Watershed Resource Consultants, co-founder of TerraGenesis International, and holds a master's degree in plant and soil science. She's worked with a variety of partner organizations on projects all over the world, including Brazil, Kenya, and as you will hear in this interview, Panama. This is her second time joining me. You will find a link to our previous interview as well as additional resources in the show notes. This interview serves as a brief overview on nutrient-dense farming, how to increase the nutrition of our foods by building better soil, and a simple way to measure these changes with a handheld tool. Rather than give too much here at the beginning, I will save my thoughts until after our conversation and let Mary get things started. If you're left with questions, please feel free to contact me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give the voicemail line a call, 717-827-6266. Before we begin, I would like to thank Nancy Grove and everyone at Old Path Farm in New Hartford, New York for their support of the show, as well as Tony Merlin. Thank you. Your donations really help. If you'd like to find out more about how you can help me make a difference, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support for details. If you have a few minutes, please leave a review on iTunes. Doing so increases the rank of the show in search listings, and the feedback helps me continue to make improvements to the quality and content of the show. Upcoming episodes include Connor Stedman returning to continue our conversation about carbon farming, this time with soils, as well as the monthly update. With all that taken care of, on to the interview. We'll be talking about nutrient-dense farming. Why don't you give us a bit of a background on this idea, and we can go from there.
Well, nutrient-dense farming, as I am beginning to understand it, involves taking care of the soil in a way that often farmers haven't been thinking about. We've been using our soils as an extractive resource where we, year after year, plant crops, and those crops harvest the nutrients that have been in the soil for millennium, and then we take those fruits and produce away from that farm, and we're not putting those same nutrients back into the soil necessarily. We've been using more and more types of conventional fertilizers and even sometimes manures or organic fertilizers, but they don't necessarily contain all of the base minerals that may have been available if it were a floodplain soil, for instance, that gathered there over the eons from deposits from glacial till or types of volcanic soil from erosion of volcanic mountain soil, things like that. So remineralization is basically thinking about the soil as a resource that you need to build, maintain that fertility and all those different levels of nutrition so that the food that's harvested actually has the highest amount of nutrition possible for that particular fruit or vegetable that you're harvesting.
So you want to start really with the soil and build the soil so that it is producing better foods then for the people who are consuming it?
That's right. And also, there are a lot of interesting side benefits to that. Obviously, we know from our doctors and from all the different vitamins that you'll find at the health food store that our bodies function better, our immune systems are more effective when we have the proper nutrition, when we have the adequate vitamins and minerals that our bodies need to function optimally. Well, plants do the same thing. So when they have the whole broad spectrum of minerals and vitamins that they need from the soil, their immune system, their ability to fight off pests, whether they're fungi or insects, is actually much stronger. So then there are less chemicals that are needed, whether they're organic or inorganic. Conventional or organic agriculture can both benefit from this. So the farm is more productive, the output is healthier, and the fruit and vegetables actually have a longer shelf life and they weigh more. So these are all benefits that the farmers receive as well from paying attention to that initial resource where the plants are growing. It's pretty amazing.
When you're talking about building soil and you mentioned glaciation and that deposition in floodplains, are you trying to match the soil with its historical profile or just using those as examples of the mineral deposits that occurred previously?
Yeah, those are just some examples. You may be in an unlucky location on the earth where there just hasn't been the same type of mineralization where the types of nutrients that a plant needs that you're trying to grow it may never have been there. So it's really about mimicking nature, but also augmenting it with the knowledge that we have from different studies of soil chemistry and plant microbiology and things. So it's really trying to take the best of both worlds and bring them together and create the ideal conditions where all of those different minerals that are needed are in the soil that you're trying to farm from. So it starts with actually getting a good soil analysis of the site that you're going to be gardening or farming. And people can do this on their home garden scale as well. It doesn't have to be a huge farm. It can be just a patch of backyard or rooftop garden. You can send a small soil sample into a specialized soil sampling lab. Not all of the typical soil labs will do these types of tests for a broader spectrum of minerals and microbiological functions. So International Ag Labs is one of the labs that will do this type of test. A lot of other soil labs probably could do the test, but that's not what they typically test for. They just look at the sort of five macronutrients or a couple of base cations and things like that. It's a little more in depth. And then what you'll get back is a recommendation from the soil lab of the different types of organic or rock dust or sea mineral types of additives that you can either spray on your crops in like a spray can or put into the soil before you plant that will help change that composition and get you the tastiest plants possible and the tastiest produce. That's the other great benefit actually, is that the flavor of what you produce actually tastes much better. It's sweeter, has a improved flavor. So that sort of leads to another interesting and fun thing about using this process for farmers and for gardeners and for getting new farmers and food enthusiasts interested in the subject is very easy to test. You can just taste different fruits and tell which one tastes better to you. You know, the palate is somewhat subjective, but in general, people find that the higher nutritional content fruit has a better flavor, but also it smells better. It has more of the aromatic kind of essential oil qualities that certain plants will produce to, again, it's usually to sort of combat other things that are trying to eat it or insects or other plants that are invading its space and that sort of thing. It's a protective mechanism, but it's part of what we enjoy about the foods that we've cultivated over time. And a simple tool that you can use in your own backyard or even just grocery shopping to figure out which fruits have the highest nutrient content is a handheld refractometer. Just this little tiny eyepiece that you put a drop of sap or a drop of juice from the food that you're checking onto a little glass plate. And then you look through the eyepiece in the sunlight and it tells you how much the light is bending through that drop of juice. So the more suspended solids are in the drop, the more nutrients are in that juice, or the more sugars and all total solids that are in there. So you want to get something that's higher on that spectrum. And there's a really handy chart that people have developed for each fruit that says, you know, a Brix reading of 4 is an indication that the soils that it's coming from are poor for that fruit. And it may go up to 18 for peaches, for example. I've been working on improving the quality of my peaches because I really love them. And it's something I just wanted to test out for myself. So I got the soil sample and I sent it off. And it turns out my soil was giving me a reading of around 8, which is sort of in the average to poor range. So I put on some amendments last year and I tested them again this year and had a little bit less insect damage. I didn't treat the trees with anything. I've just been, you know, just growing these for my own home use. And this year the reading came out at 10, which is a little bit higher, and they did taste quite a bit sweeter to me, but the best I could get to so far from what the Brix chart says is 18. So I have a ways to go still, but I'm really excited to kind of see if I can get it up there, because I can't imagine what an amazing peach that would be if it was all the way up on the 18 level.
You haven't had a chance to eat a peach at that level that someone else has grown?
I haven't. Yeah, I'm working my way up. I've just started kind of play around with testing different things as I go here and there. And I've tested some milk and found out that some farmers are testing their milk even to see what the productive level of their grazing animals is. This is used a lot in wine country and I did a little bit of work in Panama with a group called Sustainable Harvest International a couple of years back, and I brought my BRICS meter there. And this was a program that was intentionally designed to be helping people improve their nutritional quality by installing home gardens and sort of broadening the number of vegetables that families were eating and things. And so we brought the BRICS meter out, and the farmers there were so excited. They wanted to test everything. And as soon as they sort of found out that one of their tangerines or tomatoes was sort of on the poor side, they wanted to know everything about what they could do to improve the quality of it. So it's a really great way to kind of catalyze people's interest in looking at their soil and improving their production. Because people get really excited about what they produce and they want it to be as good as it possibly can be.
And then you get that buy-in from the farmers and the consumers as you bring them around the table to try these different things and see what a difference these techniques make.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great way to kind of show people a little bit of science so they can kind of see that what they're tasting is actually something that is measurable and it correlates to this information that you're passing along to them. But then it's also something that they can do themselves just by taste as they learn how to amend the soils. One of the challenges with the Panama site was that these folks that we were working with, you know, they didn't even have a decent road that they could bring any amendments out to their site. You know, it was a gully of a dirt road. There was no electricity where they were living. And so, you know, they don't have the same options as somebody here in the States who could go off to their local nutrient feed store or Agway or whatever to pick up a bag of green sand. You know, these folks, what we were trying to figure out once we realized that their soils were so poor and that they really needed to try to, in addition to teaching these folks how to grow a variety of vegetables and want to eat them, to actually figure out a way to grow their own mineral replacements to try and fix the pH of the soil a little bit and fix the carbon level in the soil and then add some of these minerals back in. That's where some of these other additives that may be in an area, if there's road construction going on, there may be moving of gravel or crushing, rock crushing happening. The rock dust that comes out of those kind of industrial processes sometimes can be what is useful for amending sites, and it's usually fairly cheap when it's a byproduct of these other industries. Sometimes if the person or the community is near the ocean, they can use composted seaweeds and diluted seawater, and depends again what the test results will say from the soils. But also, if you don't have the ability to send the soils off to a soil lab, but you have a general indicator of, you know, one section of the mountain seems to grow food much better than another, and you look at the soils, this is what we were doing in Panama, was just kind of comparing anecdotally where things grew well versus where they grew poorly, or what happened to crops in this area during a drought year versus during a flood year, and then tried to kind of get people to know their soil types by look and feel and figure out where they could map out and plan out where certain crops would be best grown as a result of that, and then try to incorporate some other green manure and bioaccumulating crops like moringa, for example, is something that can concentrate a lot of different nutrients into its leaves. And then if the farmer can harvest those leaves and dry them out and turn them into a powder, that can become a sort of a biofertilizer itself. It's concentrating those minerals out of the soil, having a deeper taproot type of system and a biophysical system that hyperaccumulates certain minerals like calcium. So then that can be grown and used as a fertilizer on areas where crops are being grown as well. So these are some of the things that for me are sort of new ideas that can be useful in all kinds of applications all around the world, besides just in our own home gardens where, you know, over time most of the food that is being produced commercially and feeding us through supermarkets has been mining out those minerals in the soil. And so our food quality over time has been declining, even though the size of the portions and the amount of produce available is far greater than it was 100 years ago. The actual individual bite of food that we're getting has lower nutritional quality than it did back before the topsoils were being heavily mined. So trying to gather this information and incorporate it into other design systems like permaculture. It's something that I'm working on a little bit. I try to incorporate a section about nutrient-dense farming now into the teaching that I do in permaculture courses or in just general workshops on farming, so that people start to find these resources and read up on them or take a course that's around through some of the different associations that are starting to use this information and try and get it out there.
From a permaculture perspective, what you were talking about in Panama, you're using that systems thinking that comes within the design processes to find those leverage points where you could make the small changes to improve the overall quality for those Panamanian citizens.
That's exactly right. In one community in particular that I was thinking of, they had these trees that were growing. They had them. They've been planted there by someone either as living fence posts or as a forage crop for cut and carry kinds of livestock applications. But there wasn't any knowledge along with that planting that they could also be using those leaves and drying them and treating their soils where they were going to grow household vegetables or trees. You know, there were tangerines at that particular farm that just tasted terrible. They were so sour because they were just not growing in a soil that was nutrient rich enough. And, you know, so we kind of did an assessment, walked around the property and saw what resources were available at hand and what was available also in the region with other neighbors that could be built into that small home scale farm to increase the nutrition for the children and the family there. Right on site, which is a little bit of tweaking, moving a few things around, or just educating people on where and how they could bring in these crops and what the results would be. So I just was very, very encouraged by how excited people were once they looked in that Brix meter themselves and they saw how one thing tasted not so great and it had a low Brix reading, and then they wanted to bring over every fruit that they had, and they went searching, and, oh, wait, I got to get my tomato, and what's the tomato supposed to be, and try this one, and, you know, it was really, really exciting and fun at that point. Everybody in the little community wanted to come over and try out theirs as well, kind of a little competitive spirit got going.
But it's a simple hands-on process that's easy to explain wherever you are.
Right, yeah, it's very visual and, you know, just peeling the fruit together and taking the drop of juice. It's real simple and straightforward, and, you know, you have a very simple meter where you see it's a 5 or it's a 6 or it's a 20, and there's not really any way of getting out of it or getting around that.
You mentioned that there are charts and tables that give you a range of what's low and what's high for individual fruits and vegetables. Is there a source for that, or is it kind of mix and match?
I got this one again from this company called International Ag Labs, which is located in Fairmont, Minnesota. They have a website, just aglabs.com, and it's a chart that you can print off. It says the chart was originally developed by someone named Dr. Kerry Reams. This is something that it's been around for a long time, this idea of a Brix level. Again, just something that, you know, you could make one for your own property if you wanted and just sort of see, well, if I start off here and I haven't done anything to my soils, you know, what does my apple come out at? And then get a few soil recommendations and treat the soil, or just start experimenting and treat the soil with different types of amendments and see if it goes up or down and see how far up your readings can go. And that's sort of how you would probably make your own chart. It's nice to sort of see what the full range of different things that have been measured are. But if you're someone who travels a lot, there may be fruits or vegetables that aren't on this chart in particular. A lot of tropical fruits and things are not on here. So in that way, you'd have to sort of start to create your own and go around and do some different measurements at the markets and see what people were bringing in and do some studying about the base soils and whether they were generally poor or had high fertility and that sort of thing.
When you're adding amendments in building your soil, a lot of the conversation that I keep running into within permaculture is, you know, add organic matter to get your compost back in, that you're covering your soil with a nice heavy mulch, because then your worms and your bacteria and everything will turn that and break it down and help to build soil and increase the fertility. But this sounds like this is definitely a step beyond that. That's a bit more measured. As you make these amendments, will it grow long-term fertility, or are you just replacing what's been lost in a different way?
Yeah, it is a little bit different than just what would happen with mulching. It's all hand in hand in some ways, having that healthy soil microfloral community, microfaunal community is a really important part of this, as it sort of keeps the whole system functioning. But again, even those microorganisms need to have certain types of nutrition available to them. Some things like fungi can actually break down harder rocks through the enzymatic processes that they do on their own, but it takes a long time, obviously, and it may not be exactly the right type of mineral that your plant that you're trying to grow will need. And different plants have different nutritional needs. So if you're trying to grow blueberries, you're not going to have the same amendment needs as if you're trying to grow cabbage necessarily, or carrots or kumquats. You'd have to sort of change the menu of amendments somewhat depending on what you wanted to grow. So it's a little more complex. But generally, if you have a really poor soil, the amendments will help just about anything. Have a better chance of developing a stronger immune system and a stronger cell wall structure and producing the biorhythmic types of flow of energies that need to happen to produce the seed and the fruit that comes that we will harvest. So basically, there are some minerals that you can add that will change the soil and improve the soil and last for decades. There are others that may be more leachable by the rain, or maybe in your area just very depleted and you need to add it every year to have it available for that crop. So there's a little bit of both. There are some types of minerals that you may add that you only need to do it once because it just wasn't there to begin with, and it's only a trace amount that's needed. But without that trace amount, there's something really critical in the physiological development of the plant that's missing. So again, just starting with your soil recommendations, there will be quite a bit of information there on where to start and how much of a certain additive you would want to apply, because you don't want to waste a lot of money or energy applying things that you don't need, and sometimes those could become pollutants if they were over-applied.
And that's where the role of the designer comes in, that we take that measure of the soil, see where it's at, add our amendments to grow its health, and then over time look for ways that we can find or add those amendments in such a way that we don't have to go out and search for them every year, that we might be able to build our own supply on our property or perhaps with a neighbor or someone in the community.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, sort of that example of in Panama, looking around at what other processes were there going on there, what sort of trees may be bringing up nutrients from a different level in the soil, or what other area on the property may have an influx of nutrients coming in from another source. Even the wind can be a source of nutrients in some areas. There's some great examples on the website of Remineralize the Earth, where a forest that was sort of in wind blow distance of a rock quarry was getting enough minerals through that dust that was blowing away from the quarry, that it was much more vibrant and alive and able to resist some major pests than its neighboring forest that just wasn't getting that additional mineral load. So there's lots of things that you can look around and pull together and try to make multiple connections and bring things together to enhance that cycle and flow of energy. And even also just returning the wastes that are coming off of your harvest back to your own land is one of those ways to keep the nutrient cycle closed rather than flow off of the property.
As we're often bidden to do, to keep cycling these different things through the system as much as possible, minimizing the need for external resources.
Yeah, that's definitely the goal that we would like to have, and then certainly reducing the distance that we need to bring things or the energy that's required to mine these types of minerals. Getting rock dust is great. It's a byproduct of another industry and it's cheaply available to us, but that doesn't mean that it isn't coming at a huge cost. There are obviously lots of fossil fuels being burned and lots of impacts from a rock quarry to begin with, so it's not exactly a benign way to remineralize your own soil, but it is important that we have nutritious food, so it's, I think, worthwhile to look at areas where there's something going on already that we can turn into a useful and beneficial side benefit for everyone.
How do you see this being integrated into and applied more broadly to permaculture. At this point, we just need awareness of this need to build nutrient-dense soil and with that nutrient-dense food, or are there other steps that you would recommend?
I think that awareness is definitely the first step. I think that some of this information wasn't necessarily readily available, and some of the field trials and things are just starting to happen now. So when Bill Mollison was writing his big textbook, for instance, this may not have had as much of a presence as it would now, perhaps. So it's mostly just getting the information out to people. Most people who are conscious about good agricultural practices and who realize the benefits that they'd receive by being able to reduce the amount of petrochemicals for pesticides and fertilizers, they'll become interested once they hear about it and once they can see results of some of the trials that are going on. And then on the home scale, there's a good movement right now. People are really appreciating taste in culinary approaches to food, where there's local food movements and there's sort of back to the farm movements. So once those folks who really appreciate the flavors in food realize that there's a way that they can actually, even just while doing their shopping, figure out where the farms are that are producing a highly flavorful food that's also more nutritious, I think it will catch on pretty quickly.
Fill the stomach, tempt the palate, and the consumer will follow along.
I think that's the way it works. We'll see.
What resources would you point people to if they want to learn more about this? What was your introduction to this idea?
Let's see, Remineralize the Earth has a website with lots of information, some great PowerPoint presentations, and they have a magazine that they put out with articles from people who are working on this. And there are folks who are interested in this in Brazil and Colombia, all over the world. People are starting to create companies where they sell these amendments because there's so much interest. So this isn't completely new or fringe or anything. This is something that serious agronomists do take seriously. So that's one place to start. Another one is the Bionutrient Food Association, and Dan Kittredge is the executive director there. He's been teaching a number of courses around the Northeast about nutrient-dense farming for a while now, and I first heard about this at a Massachusetts NOFA conference where he was giving a workshop. So if you get a chance to attend one of those, that can be really helpful, give you a lot of the sort of nerdy background science side of how this all works together. And his website has a lot of great resources, books and papers and things as well.
So if people want additional information, they can see not only the science, but also some additional work that they can do with these ideas.
Right. And they can also become part of the association and contribute to the knowledge base by starting to do their own tests on their own food and sharing the information, sharing the stories that they generate from how things go with their own experiments as well.
A community-built effort to expand the literature.
Right.
In preparation for our interview, I was doing some reading about the impacts of climate change on plants as the world continues to warm and how this type of farming could have an impact on that. Are you familiar with some of those ideas?
Well, what I understand is that less the warming effect, but more the actual change in the CO2 levels in the atmosphere will have an effect on the composition of the plants that we eat. So one of the effects of climate change, i.e. the CO2 level change, is that we will have less nutritious food. We'll have to eat more to have the same level of nutrition we have now. Again, I don't know all of the details of how extreme this will be, but this is something that I've heard is a physiological ramification for plants under the conditions that we're moving towards. So as I see it, working now on how we can boost our soils and produce the most nutritious food possible is one potential way to sort of offset some of what is going to be happening as plants adapt to these higher CO2 levels. So hopefully it's a way that we can continue to have a healthy diet and healthful foods while things are changing around us.
And something for us to consider as we're adapting our strategies and choosing the plants that we're going to bring into our communities and as Eric Tonesmeyer said, looking for plants that are already adapted to broader ranges may mean that some of those narrow range plants that we like to eat now won't have a place in our garden in the future. So as we start making selections now for something that can exist where we are for another 20, 50, 100 years, we'll have to be aware of this so that we can get them started off well and have the appropriate soil.
Right. That actually, it sort of reminds me also sort of looking back in time, again, that some of the lessons that we've, you know, trying to relearn over time. But one of the agricultural systems here in the Northeast that traditional people used was the Three Sisters system of squash, corn, and beans. But what actually was the fundamental sort of building block of the success of that system was the cycling of minerals from the sea that would return to the Northeast through the annual migration of the salmon. And the salmon were composted in the middle of the mound where those beans and corn and squash were then planted. So this is a system that these wise farmers knew they needed to bring back these important micro macro minerals that were out in the ocean that had been washed away over time back into their soil. And for them, lucky for them, their system was still functioning and that actually swam back up to them. And so they were able to eat that and return the bones and the offal back into that pile where they were planting their other highly nutritious food crops. So it's that type of system that we need to figure out how to restore and reintroduce into our farming system.
And that's where our design methods will come in to adapt what our local resources are to what we have, as opposed to trying to continue to import from somewhere else. As an introduction to this idea, and as your knowledge of this grows, and now it's been introduced to me because I'll say that I didn't know about this beforehand, other than a little bit of reading, this serves as a way to whet someone's appetite so that they can find other resources and use this information to adapt it to their local conditions. Is there anything else that you would like to add to this conversation?
I think at this point, as with all permaculture work, trying to get a little bit of activist in there, this is something about people's health. You know, our food system has been based on a way of life where we've been mining our soils, and not just through erosion, we've really been losing the wealth of our soils. And lots of famous people have sort of said before that the strength of a nation really lies in the quality of its soil. So on that level, I think the more people can look into the subject, even if they're not that interested in farming, just to find out whether what they're eating is healthy, whether they're on a health kick and they want to lose weight or they want to be an athlete or they just want to, you know, make a good meal to send their kids off to school to learn. This is really important and it should be a conversation that's on the kitchen table all across the world, really. We really need to get to the crux of this matter and help each other improve what the conversation is about agriculture. It's been about production and putting the most food out into the world. But if that food is getting less and less nutritious over time, how good are we really doing? You know, the conversation really needs to shift to how nutritious is the food that we're producing? And are we doing a good job making our farms places that will be able to continue to produce that nutritious food for years to come or not?
If anyone's interested in this, get a Brix meter, do some reading, do some testing, amend your soil, and along the way, let us know what's happening and what kind of improvements you're making and add to the body of knowledge on nutrient-dense farming. Well, Mary, thank you very much for coming to speak with me and introducing this idea to me and now to the listeners and more of the world. It sounds like it's something that we should consider as we continue to take a more holistic approach to designing sustainable systems that take care of the earth and ourselves.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
And with that discussion, we have a place to begin our exploration of nutrient-dense farming. As Mary said, when talking about the interview with Dan Kittredge, and also to me off microphone, the idea is quite nerdy, and the science behind how everything fits together is beyond the scope of what I feel comfortable discussing right now. Simply put, I'm not a botanist, or a horticulturist, or agronomist. However, the underlying idea makes sense. Provide the best soil possible to create the healthiest plants and most nutritious food. After this interview, I was left with three questions, some of which I knew something about, others which I didn't. And they were, what nutrients do plants need? What are sources for these nutrients? And how can I apply permaculture to using this information and build soil. Just as Mary provided us with an introduction, my next few minutes here are an overview. If you would like me to research these ideas in depth and provide a full episode or series on plant nutrients, soil amendments, and dynamic accumulating plants, I can do that. Just let me know. So, what nutrients do plants need? Just as we humans use fat, protein, and carbohydrates in large quantities, those are our macronutrients, plants have their own. The nutrients we need to supply are more than just these basic building blocks. We also have to think of the micronutrients, or the plant's vitamins and minerals. There are, depending on the source, 5 or 6 primary macronutrients for plants. Here I give 6. They are carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen, as well as nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. The first 3 plants can get from the air and water and process via photosynthesis. The last 3 and the other nutrients come from the soil, which is where we can amend and build to assist our plants. If you've handled a bag of fertilizer, the NPK numbers refer to the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium levels in that order. There are also secondary nutrients which are kind of in between our macro and micronutrients. They are calcium, magnesium, and sulfur. Then there are the micronutrients, which are a longer list, and they are boron, chlorine, cobalt, copper, iron, manganese, molybdenum, nickel, silicon, sodium, zinc, and vanadium. The primary and secondary nutrients are fairly simple to test soil for, and most soil labs should be able to test for them. The micronutrients, however, may require more specialized labs to sort them out for you. If you want to have these soil tests done, in the United States, aglabs.com can provide these services. Elsewhere in the world, contact a local soil or environmental testing lab and ask if they provide micronutrient soil tests, and they should be able to help you. And if they don't, then can point you in the right direction. In the show notes is a link to a PDF on plant nutrients from Northeastern Oklahoma A&M that I like for its simplicity in presenting and explaining each of the nutrients, as well as how they impact plants, which soils are likely to have issues retaining these nutrients, and a wealth of other information. If you use the information in that document, combined with a soil analysis, including trace minerals, it can help you determine what amendments to add and in what quantities so that you can build your soil to an ideal mix for your plants. And then as you move forward and begin to make these changes, you can use the handheld bricks meter that Mary referred to measure these increases as you watch those numbers increase or decrease and see how these changes are impacting your plants. But if you're going to make these amendments, there's that second question. What are sources for these nutrients? The list of amendments useful for any particular nutrient, of course, varies. Bone meal is good for phosphate and calcium. Compost is rich in nitrogen and carbon. Urine is high in nitrogen with good quantities of potassium and phosphorus. Green sand is chock full of potassium, iron, magnesium, silica, and many other trace minerals. A trip to the garden center or DIY shop can provide bags and bags of everything we could generally need. But what if you're looking for one particular nutrient that's deficient? In that case, a little bit of research is your friend. I chose the first micronutrient on the list, boron, and did a web search, Boron for the Garden. The first link took me to an article from Spectrum Analytic, a testing lab in Ohio. At the bottom of that article was a list of sources for boron. Surprisingly, a common household product, borax, is a good source. You can do this kind of search for every nutrient that you may need to get your soil moving in the right direction, and continue to play and experiment until you find what works best in your environment. But as you continue to make these changes, how can you apply permaculture to acquiring rather than buying these nutrients and in turn build your soil? I think Mary actually provided a good description of this process in her discussion of the Panamanian village. Use your ability to observe to determine where certain plants will grow best. Use your knowledge. If you know certain plants share similar requirements in regards to their nutritional and growing conditions, look for some of these other species in the landscape, and you could grow your similar plant there. Experiment with your slow and simple solutions. Do some test plantings across a property. See where certain things grow better, and find that ideal location, and then replicate that. Value your renewable resources by using your accumulating plants like comfrey, slash, and mulch plants. You can also use those same plants to mine nutrients from one area and move the minerals now trapped in the plant tissue somewhere else. A good foundation in the ethics and principles of permaculture can truly let you design anything. And remember, permaculture is, as a design system, largely based on our available information and the ability to apply that information creatively. We now live in a world that is more connected than any other time in history. You can find solutions to almost any questions related to building a better world by asking around. Do that web search. Send an email to someone who you respect. Reach out to people who are experts in their field, be they permaculture designers and consultants or scientists. There's plenty of information to go around to make these things happen. Look, ask, find out. And until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.